Welcome to Class Matters, an educational program examining the role played by social classes and the class divide in the U.S. and around the world. I'm Rich Whitney.
And I'm Paula.
We discuss matters of class because class matters. And today on Class Matters, wanted to continue with a, well, at least a two-part series. Maybe it'll turn into a three-part series, I don't know. About the subject of regulatory capture. And last week we began, actually we've been doing this periodically over the last few months, but last week we began an article by the Midwestern Doctor, whom you can find at MidwesternDoctor.com. That is a pseudonym for an actual Midwestern doctor who has been quite a critic of the pharmaceutical medical industrial complex. And he wrote an article at that website back in October called How Big Pharma Bought the Federal Government, talking about this phenomenon of regulatory capture, the agencies that are supposed to be protecting us from corporate malfeasance and corporate harm and injuring people, because to the extent that it helps them with their bottom line and all that sort of thing. Basically, the agencies that are supposed to protect us from the worst excesses of capitalism have themselves been captured by the corporations that they are supposed to be regulating. And this Midwestern doctor has been very comprehensive and has a lot of facts, both in this article and some of the early articles that we've done. And when we left off last week, he had been talking about one of the methods of corruption is actually Congress set up these foundations that then help support these agencies financially, but without actual tax dollars. Instead, what these foundations do is become kind of a, well, money laundering operation, basically.
Yeah.
Because when the corporate donors give to the foundation, they're not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. Money flows there and they can corrupt the agency, but it's very difficult to see exactly how much they're corrupting it and so on and so forth. But intrepid journalists and so on do some homework and they're able to find some of this stuff.
You know, we always hear about how the corporations moved to China because of the low wages and the lack of regulations.
Right.
Well, the way I understand it, in China, they don't have regulatory agencies. But if you kill a bunch of people, then you get killed. If you're a corporation
right.
owner and you kill, like, remember the formula that killed like 40 babies? You dead. You know,
yeah.
And I suppose that it's hard to capture that kind of thing. There's no
right.
agency set up to protect people. It's just that if you kill people, then you will be killed.
Yeah.
Kind of. What is it? Focuses the mind a bit, I would imagine.
Yeah, fear of death is a form of regulation,
yes,
I suppose. Maybe kind of a dramatic one.
Maybe we need to go to that,
well,
is what
maybe.
I'm saying. Because this FDA, you know, this regulatory capture is across the board. Everything we're trying to protect, they have subverted it and turned it into something else. So maybe we just need to go to just wipe out the regulatory agencies. And if someone kills somebody, a corporation kills somebody, then the CEO gets it.
Yeah, yeah. That's food for thought. Let's put it that way. And so the Midwestern doctor gave examples of the foundation for the CDC, and there was another one for NIH. And then he started talking about the FDA and was giving some examples of that. And where we left off, he gave the example of the current FDA commissioner, Robert Califf, who in 2009 was considered to be too close to the industry to nominate to the position, yet in 2021 was appointed to it.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Yeah. And ever since gaining control of the FDA has advanced the interests of his industry.
What a shock.
Yeah.
Like that guy DeJoy that is the postmaster general that's pretty much ruining the post office because he owns stock in Federal Express or something like that. Oh, great. Put the fox in charge of the hen house, why don't you?
That's what this is all about. That's going on in agency after agency, and that's the phenomenon that we're trying to reveal here. And Midwestern Doctor gives an example. Shortly after the backdoor approval of a controversial Alzheimer's drug, Califf was a keynote speaker at the annual pharmaceutical industry conference, which emphasized the incredible investment opportunities offered by the new Alzheimer's and obesity drugs, which the agency was also pushing through.
Oh, they're really pushing that obesity drug now. Mm. And I've heard it kills people. It makes them so they lose weight and then they starve to death, some people.
Wow, wow, yeah. That's definitely a downside.
Some CEO needs to have his head rolling.
Yeah. He continues, furthermore, in addition to being overtly compensated by the industry for supporting its interests, for example, Califf had taken a lot of money from Big Pharma, a revolving door also exists to pay them off after the fact. Consider, for instance, that the second official appointed by Trump to head the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, is now on Pfizer's board.
That reminds me of the guy that was the head of the FDA and under Clinton, the Michael somebody or other that worked for Monsanto.
Oh, right.
And then after Clinton left, he went back to Monsanto. And then when Obama came in, well, look, there he is again, right back at the FDA.
Yeah.
Michael Taylor, I think his name was.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. Likewise, Stephen Hahn, the commissioner who is in charge of the FDA for the entirety of Operation Warp Speed, and as Peter Navarro showed against the president's orders, actively sabotaged affordable and effective treatments for COVID-19, Hahn is now an executive for the venture capital firm that launched Moderna, and thus owns a significant part of it. This issue exists beyond the healthcare sector. For instance, Lloyd Austin was first a four-star general under Obama, then left to become a board member for Raytheon, and then left that position to become Biden's Secretary of Defense. Since becoming in charge of our military, one of the worst wars in modern history has broken out, which coincidentally required a massive amount of weaponry to be purchased from defense contractors like Raytheon.
Cha-ching!
Yep. All of this has effectively created a pay-to-play situation, where it's almost impossible to get a drug approved unless you have a lot of money, and as a result, therapies that put people before profits have a very difficult time getting through. This was best shown throughout COVID-19, where numerous teams were unable to receive an EUA, emergency use authorization, or sometimes even permission to conduct American trials for safe therapies that had strong evidence they were effective in treating COVID-19, while awful but highly lucrative therapies, like remdesivir, Paxlovid, and molnupiravir, sailed through the approval process.
They became mandatory.
Yeah. Given that the Prescription Drug User Fee Act was originally created during the AIDS crisis to help expedite emergency therapies being approved.
Fauci again.
Yeah, right. Being approved to treat novel diseases. It's noteworthy the exact opposite ultimately happened. Note, I was heavily involved with one team which attempted to secure an EUA, and it was depressing how high a standard we were held to compared to Pfizer. Likewise, a big part of why Steve Kirsch originally got involved with the vaccine issue was because he provided a wealth of evidence and funded the original clinical trial that demonstrated an already FDA-approved drug was a highly effective treatment for COVID-19, but was stonewalled in receiving an EUA from the FDA, which Kirsch was told from an insider also sabotaged fluvoxamine, making it into the NIH's COVID treatment guidelines. One of the classic tactics propagandists and marketers use to manipulate the public is to have a quote-unquote independent party, especially a trustable one, endorse the sponsor's position. Because of this, you frequently find that a variety of nice-sounding third parties, for example, many of those which advocate for helping patients with specific medical conditions, are taking money from corporate sponsors and ultimately advance positions that serve their sponsors' interests. A common way this technique is utilized is by delegating important policy decisions to impartial committees of qualified experts. That way, the conclusions they come to are perceived to be objective truth rather than the work of a corrupt bureaucrat, even though in reality the corrupt bureaucrat calls the shots by deciding who ends up on the committee. For example,
and the pharmacy corporations control the bureaucrat.
Yeah, there you go. For example, in COVID-19, much of the death that happened was the result of no effective treatments existing for COVID-19, and instead only dangerous ones like remdesivir being permitted, which seems odd given that the evidence for remdesivir was appalling, whereas the evidence for many of the other treatments was phenomenal. Let's in turn consider the evidence and cost of each approved treatment for COVID-19. The EU list can be found here, the NIH treatment guidelines here, and he's got links to that. And then he provides this really interesting chart. And of course, you'll have to go to the article at the website to see the chart. Basically, it's showing all the different studies that were done of different treatment therapies that they tried for COVID-19 in the early days. And if you look at the actual results, like iota-carrageen, 80% improvement, or ivermectin, oh, that's horse paste.
Yeah, I remember that.
62% improvement after 99 studies. And it goes on from melatonin, 43%. But, you know, nobody's going to pay a lot of money for melatonin, and so on. And then you go down the list, and you get down to Paxlovid. Well, that's only 28% effective. Or remdesivir, only 10% effective, whereas there are all kinds of adverse side effects.
And again, they mandated remdesivir. They said that is the only thing you can give in the hospital.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's really, really revealing. From looking at this list, it seems clear the primary determinant of if a treatment ended up in the guidelines was if it did not treat the infection, instead only providing symptomatic management, which was often dangerous, or if it was a lucrative product someone was making money off of. In short, our regulators appear to be focused on protecting the market rather than the American people.
Markets are important.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
This is what you call a public-private partnership.
Yeah, especially when you can manipulate the results.
Yeah.
Interestingly, when the National Institutes for Health Committee, which created the COVID-19 treatment guidelines, was looked into, it was discovered that most of them had taken money from Gilead, that's remdesivir's manufacturer. Yeah. Furthermore, as an example, he's got a link to another article which discusses how Fauci chose to appoint one of his longtime associates to chair that committee. According to a recent government investigation, the NIH spent approximately $162 million developing remdesivir. Likewise, the official Fauci appointed to chair the committee which monitored the safety of the COVID-19 vaccines while they were being tested was a board member of Gilead, and numerous members of the FDA committee, which horrendously voted to approve the vaccine for children, had previously worked for Pfizer.
I would just like to point out that remdesivir was developed for Ebola. That was the end disease.
The original, yeah.
The end bioweapon disease that they started it for, but they tested it in Africa where the Ebola patients were, and it killed half of them, so they quit the drug trials.
Right.
I guess they were more honest there than they are here. That's what they developed it for. That's the only thing they ever tried it on. It had never been approved for anything else. And then all of a sudden they go, you know what? It's mandated for COVID if you're in the hospital.
Yeah, yeah. He goes on to say, the best argument I've seen in defense of the government hiring experts who are taking money from the company whose drug they're evaluating is that so many experts are being paid off now, it's extremely challenging to find academically qualified individuals for these committees who do not also have significant conflicts of interest.
Well, that's where you go back to the whole university thing.
Yeah, yeah, right. So we have a pandemic of corruption is what we
sure
have here.
We sure do.
Yeah.
Yeah, where the universities are taking money from private corporations to develop research for them.
Yeah.
And then when they develop the research, then they get picked as the impartial professor that's going to look at this.
Yep, yeah. Sadly, COVID was not the first time a corrupt committee's guidelines have had massive consequences for the world. Consider this example from Chapter 7 of the book Doctoring Data. Quote, the National Cholesterol Education Program has been tasked by the NIH to develop guidelines everyone uses for treating cholesterol levels, excluding the chair, who is by law prohibited from having financial conflicts of interest. The other eight members, on average, were on the payroll of six statin manufacturers. That's on average. Six different ones. In 2004, the National Cholesterol Education Program reviewed five large statin trials and recommended aggressive LDL lowering for high-risk patients, primary prevention with lifestyle changes, and statins. In 2005, a Canadian division of the Cochrane Collaboration, who were not paid off, reviewed five large statin trials. Three were the same as NCEPs, while the other two had also reached a positive conclusion for statin therapy. That assessment instead concluded statins have not been shown to provide an overall health benefit in primary prevention trials.
But, you know, many doctors still believe the official story, as you know.
Yeah. Statins are widely considered to be one of the most dangerous and ineffective drugs on the market. When deciding on approving a new drug, the FDA seeks the advice of an outside advisory panel about half of the time, typically for more controversial or less understood drugs. In those cases, the FDA is more likely than not to agree with that panel. One study evaluating 416 decisions made between 1997 and 2012 found the FDA followed the advice of its panel 84% of the time, and when the FDA overruled its panel, 61% of those decisions were to have a drug rejected by the committee nonetheless be approved. Some of the more noteworthy recent overrulings included, first, approving an extremely expensive Alzheimer's drug, which did not work, but did frequently cause brain bleeding and swelling, which could be fatal.
Oh, I remember that one.
Yeah, that's fairly recent, yeah.
Yeah.
That drug was unanimously rejected by the advisory committee, and when the FDA still chose to approve it, three members of that panel permanently resigned from their advisory capacity. Another example, a CDC advisory panel voted in favor of giving the booster 6 months after the second shot to those over 65 and for those with health factors that put them at risk for a severe COVID-19 infection, but against recommending it to workers who are more likely to come in contact with COVID. The CDC overruled that final decision and advised it for everyone, which in turn resulted in it being mandated for much of the American population, since many use the CDC's so-called voluntary guidelines to craft their policies.
Corruption up and down.
Yep. Around the same time the CDC overruled its committee, the FDA also overruled its advisory committee's decision to not approve boosters for the general population, which coincided with the resignation of two senior FDA officials in its vaccine division, one of whom joined a vaccine nonprofit, and the other who became a board member for a biotech company.
Didn't they overrule their advisory committee, said, no, don't make it mandatory for children, and they did anyhow?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, gosh, it's like they want to kill people.
Well,
at this point.
Well, they want to keep selling the stuff.
Well,
so
that's, yeah, I guess that's it. Then they don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
Because so most people can survive just about anything you throw at them.
Yeah,
is the truth.
So there's a little collateral damage, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even the diseases we think of as deadly, like, you know, measles. Like, it's like 99% of people got measles, survived it. You know,
right,
even
right.
Smallpox. Not everyone died from smallpox. So, yeah, people are pretty amazing in the things they can survive.
Yeah. Yeah. In 1980, the Bayh-Dole Act was passed, which gave researchers whose research was funded by taxpayer money and their universities the patent and royalty rights to any drugs they developed. The act was intended to help facilitate discoveries making it to the marketplace, which was a valid point since things moved very slowly on when the federal government retained control of their patents. But at the time, many worried it would corrupt the national research apparatus.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah. Not long after, as detailed within Chapter 7 of The Real Anthony Fauci, that's the book by Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Which everyone should read, even though it's really hard to read because his margins are gone. Has no margins.
Well, yeah, some issues with the actual physical book. But
yeah.
Anyway, Fauci entered the scene and began transforming our national research apparatus into a pharmaceutical production pipeline. For example, to quote a 2021 interview with RFK Jr., quote, between 2009 and 2016, there were hundreds of drugs approved by the FDA. Virtually all of them came out of Fauci's NIH pharmaceutical production pipeline.
Jeez, he's so corrupt.
Yep.
And then he was the highest paid federal employee on top of it.
Yeah.
He's the highest paid federal employee, and then he's skimming all these billions of dollars, or millions anyhow, of dollars from these companies.
That's right. RFK Jr. recently estimated that Fauci's agency owns 2,200 drug patents, many of which have been lucratively licensed to pharmaceutical manufacturers. Similar conflicts of interest also exist for the NIH and CDC, which may help to explain why the CDC always recommends every vaccine. This transformation was greatly accelerated by Fauci's maneuvers during the AIDS crisis, creating a hysteria about the disease, blocking all effective treatments for it from coming to market, and making the deadly AZT be approved and then become the standard of care, which allowed him to get his agency, the NIAID, a massive discretionary budget, a global influence over scientific research and international health policy, and a large influence over the FDA and CDC. In effect, Fauci gained control over the national research apparatus, which, amongst other things, was why he was able to destroy the careers of scientists like Peter Duisberg, who challenged him, as he could cut off their access to the grants every career scientist depends upon and make many reluctant to hire those who had crossed him. To create his pipeline, Fauci did the following. First, he assembled a network of clinical investigators, PIs, around the country who would test those drugs, often in a highly unethical manner. He concealed the financial conflicts of interest from the trial participants, who likely would not have consented if they'd known they were guinea pigs for an investment.
He used foster children in New York to experiment with.
He worked diligently to conceal the money everyone was making from the royalties on those drugs. He used the money this pipeline brought in from the pharmaceutical industry to gradually buy out our regulators so they would push along his dangerous and unproven drugs. The Midwestern Doctor adds a note here that Fauci's wife, Christine Grady, is the nation's chief bioethicist.
Oh, God. The ethics of that.
Yeah.
To have her, his wife, be the one saying whether he's ethical or not.
Yeah.
It's insane.
It is. Throughout her tenure, she has used her position to successfully lobby for Fauci's policies, namely all of the horrendous ones we saw throughout COVID-19, to be deemed, quote-unquote, ethical. In short, Fauci made the Bayh-Dole Act become something far worse than its harshest critics had imagined. To quote Vera Sharav, a Holocaust survivor who has run a nonprofit directed at investigating unethical human experimentation and spent years investigating the NIAID's conduct, quote, "Beginning around 1990, clinical trials became the profit center for the medical community. The insurance industry and HMOs were squeezing doctors so that it became hard to make big money practicing medicine. The most ambitious doctors left patient care and gravitated toward clinical trials. Everybody involved was making money except the subjects of the human experiments. At the center of everything was NIH and NIAID. While people were not paying attention, the agency quietly became the partner of the industry." RFK aptly summarizes the immense scope of Fauci's enterprise. Between 2010 and 2016, every single drug that won approval from the FDA, 210 different pharmaceuticals, originated at least in part from research funded by the NIH. At the time all of this happened, the pharmaceutical industry had far less control over the media, as it was only in 1997 that directly advertising pharmaceutical products became legal in the United States.
Another giant step for corruption.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how they bought the media.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. This resulted in an ever-increasing amount of advertising dollars coming from the pharmaceutical industry, which in turn allowed the industry to be able to leverage media companies into never-airing content critical of the industry. Best illustrated by the fact that in 1976, a far less dangerous but still dangerous experimental vaccine was recklessly deployed on America, and after a significant number of people were injured, candid admissions of this were seen on mainstream news networks, something which is not allowed in today's much more corrupt media climate.
That's for sure.
And we talked about that. Actually, he had a whole another article or two on that subject, which we talked about a couple of months ago, talking about the thing with the Phil Donahue show and so on.
Yeah, it was amazing how much it showed up on.
Yeah.
And then did we talk about the RSV vaccine that they brought out in the 60s?
Yes.
That one only killed about 7 kids and they took it off the market.
Yeah.
Because back then they could get sued. They didn't get executed like in China, but they could be sued before 1986 when they got immunized against lawsuits.
Yeah.
But they took that off the market. Now they're bringing a new RSV vaccine on, but now they're not just targeting kids who are the ones who can actually get sick from RSV. They're targeting the entire population.
Yeah, yeah.
98% of Americans have had RSV by the time they're 2 years old, but they're telling you that you can get it and you can die.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's literally cold symptoms when you're over 2.
Yeah.
And even under 2, most of them are fine.
Yeah.
It's again, like I said, even the worst disease that's very, very harmful to a few, most people, most humans just sail right through it because we have evolved over millions of years. Not we haven't been around for billions of years, but over millions of years, we've evolved to be able to handle this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not all these chemicals.
Yeah. So he's got a link in this article to a 60 Minutes thing about swine flu. I think it was the swine flu vaccine that he was talking about there.
Yeah.
So you can actually watch that example. And some of his earlier articles had other links to other videos like that.
It was actually really a good one. I've watched that.
Yeah, yeah. Outside of the United States, direct pharmaceutical advertising remains illegal in most countries. New Zealand is the only other country that fully allows it, while Canada partially allows it. As a result, in the past, the press was much more willing to criticize Fauci's conduct. For example, this is what the BBC's investigator from its 2004 Guinea Pig Kids documentary...
That's what I was talking about, I think.
Yeah, yeah. ...shared about one of Fauci's experiments, which forced many of the participants to take the medications against their consent. Quote, "I found the mass grave at Gate of Heaven Cemetery in Hawthorne, New York. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was a very large pit with astroturf thrown over it, which you could actually lift up. Under it, one sees dozens of plain wooden coffins, haphazardly stacked. There may have been 100 of them. I learned there was more than one child's body in each. Around the pit was a semicircle of several large tombstones on which upward of 1,000 children's names had been engraved. I wrote down every name. I'm still wondering who the rest of those kids were. As far as I know, nobody has ever asked Dr. Fauci that haunting question."
Well, that's the joy of using foster children, right?
Yeah, right. "I remember the teddy bears and hearts and piles around the pit, and I recall the flies buzzing around. The job of recording all those names took all day. NIAID, New York, and all the hospital PIs were stonewalling us. We couldn't get any accurate estimate of the number of children who died in the NIAID experiments or who they were. I went to check the gravestone names against death certificates at the New York City Department of Health, which you could still do at that time."
Well, that's what I was saying last week. This should all be transparent.
Yeah.
It's a public Department of Health. You should be able to find out who died.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to have a Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah, that's right.
It should all be public knowledge. It's a public agency. The public should be able to know what they're doing.
Yep. BBC wanted to match these coffins to the names of children who were known to have been at ICC. It was a very slow Byzantine project with tremendous institutional resistance, but we did turn up a few names. This story ran in the New York Post, believe it or not. But one after the other, every media outlet that touched this story got cold feet. Even then, the medical cartel had this power to kill this kind of story. Dr. Fauci has built his career on that attitude. Nobody even asks him a follow-up question. NIAID's narrative at that time was that these children were among the doomed as they had AIDS, so supposedly they were all going to die anyway. When people died in large number, gruesome deaths, NIAID's medical researchers called it, quote, lessons learned, unquote. Wow.
Well, they didn't, though, did they? Because here we are with the
COVID
vaccine.
Yeah, here we are, right. Another lucrative HIV drug, nevirapine, was pushed through by Fauci and his AIDS branch, DAIDS, when it was unethically tested in Africa on mothers and their children to prevent HIV transmission. As Paula was pointing out earlier, thousands of adverse events occurred, including dozens of deaths, which Fauci hid from the FDA. Later, when similar injuries occurred within the United States, Jonathan Fishbein, MD, who in 2003 was hired to oversee DAID's research, tried to bring attention to these serious research violations. This resulted in Fauci firing Fishbein from DAIDS, and after a lengthy whistleblower investigation was conducted by Congress, it instituted an annual cap of $150,000 on the royalties each government scientist could receive each year for the drugs they helped develop. Well, there's more to this, more about the media companies that were, at least in years past, were willing to criticize Fauci, but now don't dare, there's too much money at stake, etc. But we're just about out of time. Again, the article we've been reading from and sharing with you can be found at MidwesternDoctor.com. It's a Substack, but you can hit the No Thanks button if you want to preview it and read some of the articles. And this article from October 10th of last year is entitled How Big Pharma Bought the Federal Government. Indeed. Well, thanks for listening to Class Matters. We will be returning to this subject, no doubt, at some point, and we'll be with you again next Monday.